Welcome to In My Backyard, an open conversation about children and mental health. We all know a child who's struggling, whether that child tells us or not. In this podcast, we speak with experts on the many factors of emotional distress in children, how to address those factors, and how to create a community where all children can be healthy and happy. This podcast is made possible through generous donations from supporters and listeners like you. Please visit tgclb.org or text HOPE to 562-262-5689 to make a one-time donation or join our Hope and Healing Club to become a monthly donor today. Your host is Tricia Costales, CEO of the Guidance Center, a nonprofit children's mental health agency in Long Beach, California.
I'm Tricia Costales, your host of In My Backyard. I'm a licensed clinical social worker and the chief executive officer of the Guidance Center, a nonprofit children's mental health agency serving 3,500 children and families every year. We spoke in prior episodes about the impact of trauma and chronic stress on a child's brain and how this impacts their functioning and resiliency. Today, we'll take our understanding of stress and mental health and apply it to children and teens with chronic illnesses. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, chronic illnesses in children can affect the physical, cognitive, social, and emotional development of young patients. Depression and anxiety are common comorbid illnesses in children with chronic health concerns. This is supported by Dr. Anne-Marie Brady from the Queen Mary University of London. She and her research team found that children with chronic health conditions were twice as likely to present with a diagnosable mental health disorder at ages 10 and 13, and 60% more likely at age 15. This held true even with children whose physical health condition was relatively mild and well controlled with medication. They found further that the mental health impairment was worse for chronically ill children who were bullied for their illness or who had high rates of school absenteeism for health-related reasons. Very often, with a chronic or potentially terminal illness, families and medical staff are so understandably focused on the physical health of the child that the emotional, developmental, and psychological impacts of the illness and treatment are overlooked. Doctors Jennifer Rohan and Tanvi Verma write that 82% of pediatric cancer survivors demonstrate emotional and psychological struggles, but only 38% are referred to mental health services. They found that psychological distress and decreased quality of life concerns held true against all pediatric age groups where a chronic illness is present. But teens report additional difficulties. These include a threatened sense of safety and reduced security, feelings of loss of control, body image concerns, decreased self-esteem and modified sense of self, difficulties with interpersonal relationships, disruptions in daily life, increased parent-adolescent conflict, and a threatened sense of independence. It is no wonder, then, that depression is so common among this vulnerable group of children. As Rohan and Verma noted, it is well documented that improved mental health functioning has a positive impact on overall health functioning, and that the reverse is also true. Given this, it seems such an oversight that mental health support is not more commonly incorporated into the treatment plan of all chronically ill children. In today's podcast, we're going to speak with Dr. Lauren Ford. Lauren is a licensed psychologist and pediatric psychologist in the Guidance Center's Whole Child program. The Whole Child is a program that places Guidance Center pediatric psychologists in Miller Children's Hospital to provide consultation and mental health support to children and families with chronic illnesses. In many cases, therapists are able to support the child when they are inpatient in the hospital as well as between hospital visits. Welcome, Lauren. Thank you for joining us today. I have the great advantage of knowing you professionally. I've had such fun watching you develop and grow the Whole Child program since its inception. You've done it with such empathy and wisdom. But for our audience who don't know you, will you please share a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Thank you. I am extremely grateful to be able to have a job that I could not love more. And to be able to grow our program over these, you know, last, I guess, 6 years now. So I am a licensed psychologist. I have kind of an interesting background. I'm trained both in trauma psychology and community mental health work, and also in pediatric psychology, which is what we're going to be talking about today. And that's the looking at the contribution of mental health to the chronic illness process in children and youth.
Excellent. You know, I'd like to understand a little bit more about the children in the whole child. I know that every child presents with a very different story. They present differently. But will you please sort of tell us a little bit about the children you treat, what kinds of illnesses bring them to care, and what sorts of struggles are they and their families facing?
Yeah. So I think generally speaking, the population that we see in the whole child program is demographically not different than the population that the guidance center sees in its broad programs. We see a population that is 98% Medi-Cal insured. We have a large refugee population. Many of our patients do not have English as their first language. They are under-resourced, marginalized, and in many ways. And I think that gets accentuated when you think about how healthcare plays out for children and vulnerable families. I would say when we think about what the presentation of the children in the whole child program looks like, we see definitely an abundance of the chronic illnesses that disproportionately affect underserved youth. So those would be things like asthma, diabetes, some of the GI disorders. And also when we think, you know, more broadly about kind of dimensions of diversity and how we think about cultural idioms of distress, we also see some somatic concerns that we treat in our program as well.
I know what somatic concerns are, but our listeners may not. Could you explain, please, what you mean by that?
Certainly. So somatic complaints is kind of a broad term that means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But generally, we think about, you know, distress, emotional distress, stress in general in the body being manifested in a physical way. And so the easiest way to kind of think about this is like when you get nervous, usually you have a physical representation of that nervousness as well as an emotional and cognitive response, right? So you think about the thing that you're worried about. You might even feel what it means to be anxious. And then you also might get like, for example, a tension headache or a stomach ache, right? We consider those to be somatic complaints, right? Those are physical kind of ramifications of your body's stress response system. And for some children who have a biological kind of predisposition towards this, we see those symptoms in extreme. And that's what we see in our whole child program.
In preparing for our conversation today, I was doing quite a lot of reading about this very issue. And I read about very high rates of mental health struggles amongst children with a chronic physical illness. And given what we already know about stress and trauma, that made me sad, but I wasn't surprised by what I read. So in your experience as someone who's really on the front lines of this, have you found it to be true that a chronic illness is a risk factor for a mental health issue in children?
Oh, certainly. Certainly, I think this is definitely true. We see this kind of play out anecdotally. And I think, well, I actually think about this in two ways. So the first is, you know, all of the research on psychosocial adjustment to chronic illness suggests that children who are diagnosed with a chronic illness, depending upon what that illness is and how sick they are and things like that, are between 2 and 5 times more likely to develop a mental health condition as compared to their same aged healthy peers. So that's, I mean, very extreme. And it sounds like that's what you saw when you were reading up on this. And then if you consider the population we treat in the whole child program as being similar to the population that the guidance center generally treats, we also factor in, I think, adverse childhood experiences or ACEs, right? And we know that ACEs really do predispose us to a number of different outcomes, including chronic illness and increased risk of mental health concerns.
Interesting. So in some ways, those same adverse childhood experiences that we've talked about in prior episodes that can lead to psychological distress can also lead to physical distress?
Certainly. The ACEs study that came out, you know, years and years ago showed that, there's an exponential increase in being predisposed to having a number of pretty much any chronic illness you can think of as you kind of rack up your ACE score. And so it's both, definitely.
And what kinds of psychological impacts have you seen? How is it sort of manifested in the children? Diagnostically or behaviorally, what is it that you see?
That's a great question. So I think we most frequently in the whole child program actually diagnose adjustment disorder. And I think that that's a really kind of good way to think about what might be going on from a mental health perspective. Most chronic illnesses are hard to manage, even ones that are not, you know, necessarily considered to be life limiting. They involve a lot of care, a lot of doctor's appointments, a lot of disruption to your life, thinking about managing pain and uncomfortable symptoms. All of those things contribute to your quality of life, and they take a lot of ongoing adjustment. So we definitely diagnose that. I would say that we also see a pretty significant amount of depression and anxiety, worrying about health symptoms, worrying about illness progression, then mood-related concerns associated with being different, and also just the general kind of process of what it means to live your life with a chronic illness that may have symptoms that are unpredictable, or may have symptoms that are embarrassing or undesirable or hard for other people to understand, hard for families to manage. All of that kind of contributes to what we see.
You know, one of the things that really struck me in one of the studies I was reading, you know, a lot of this you can say, oh, that makes sense. If you have a very ill child, a child with leukemia, a child with type 1 diabetes, things that can be really life-threatening, you can understand. But one of the studies I read showed that even with illnesses that are comparatively less severe, I guess you could say, they could be relatively well managed with medications like asthma, you still see the same psychological distress as a result of that illness. And that really struck me. Could you speak to that?
Yeah. So I think asthma and diabetes are really good examples of chronic illnesses that A, disproportionately affect our population, and B, I think are considered by the general population to be illnesses that can be well managed with medication. And that is indeed true. They can be well managed with medication. But I think what a lot of people don't see is what it means to be well managed and the amount of work, not just from the individual who's diagnosed with the chronic illness, but from the entire system or systems that support that child, the amount of work that really goes into that. And it's exhausting. It is relentless. And it's a lot. So for example, somebody with diabetes, right, they check their blood sugar, 4 to 5 times a day. So that's a needle prick in a finger. If you think about a teenager, they have to do that at school, in front of people, they have to disrupt their daily schedule to go to the nurse's office to do it. They can't just go out with their friends and have pizza. They have to think about, I'm going to eat this. What is my blood sugar? How do I administer insulin in order to cover for that? I have to do math associated with how much insulin I need based on what I'm going to eat and what my pre-existing baseline blood sugar is. I mean, the list kind of just goes on and on and on to do something that is as simple as eat a slice of pizza with your friends, right? Like a normal developmental activity. And so I think, yes, these things can be well controlled with medication, but not without impact that is pretty significant on the individual's life. And so that's why we really do see the psychosocial concerns present in these illnesses as well. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. It does make sense. I'd like very much so, and I find it so interesting. I'd like to sort of flesh out a little bit more about what you just said, because I think that child who wants a slice of pizza with their friends but is diabetic, you know, I have a person in my life who has type 1 diabetes, and he wears a sensor, but still, yeah, it's a constant presence in his life. It's constant. Yeah. You know, and that's never going to go away. That's never going to change. So I can see what a burden it is to him as an adult. So I think about sort of the developmental stages of a child. His is type 1 diabetes, but it was adult onset. So, but if you're a child, or, you know, a little one, or you're a teenager where, oh my gosh, being different is so sort of alarming. And like, how does that process of being ill in some way change your developmental stages or your developmental roles?
Yeah, I think it, you know, like so many other things, it depends. it depends on so many factors. But I think this idea of having an experience where the systems that promote typical development look different for you when you have a chronic illness is a large part of the impact that we see, right? So in and out of the hospital, if things aren't well managed, having frequent doctor's appointments, having a very public aspect to your illness, you know, kids who are young are very concrete. Their understanding of illness is usually the cold that they get, that they have been told is transmissible to other people, or it's that grandma or grandpa has cancer and died. There is no like gray area, right? And so when they interact with a peer who might be ill, like those are the things they're thinking about. And so you can see how children quickly get marginalized. In fact, you know, when kids come into the hospital with diabetes, one of the things we always ask is, do your friends know you even have diabetes? And I would say it's probably 60% will say no, definitely not. I don't tell them.
I can't imagine how you manage your diabetes all day at school without people knowing. Exactly. It's hard to be private about all the work that goes into it.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, for teenagers, it makes a lot of sense. You want to belong. And so what ends up happening is that the diabetes care kind of gets as small and minimal as possible. So as kind of not to out yourself or be different. I think it makes a lot of sense when we think about development that that's what happens. And so adherence concerns are something that we work on a lot in our program, a lot.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I read about too, I mean, everything that you're saying makes so much sense to me. So then it's striking that, you know, I read in the literature that most kids with a chronic physical illness do not get mental health support, despite what we know about the links between the two. And in some ways, if you step back, that might make sense to some degree, that doctors or parents, if you have a physically ill child, you're trying to keep them alive. You're trying to keep them healthy. And of course, that takes the priority. But I would like to hear from you, who's integrated into a program like this. Talk to me and to our listeners about why it's so vital that we incorporate mental health services in the medical treatment plan.
Yeah. So this is my passion area.
I know
so,
this. I just
like a little excited
throw
about this.
Through you the easiest lob.
I
Go
know,
for
right?
It.
There are so many answers to this, and I think, you know, to be fair to physicians, especially physicians in primary care, they are the quarterback of the team. They have so much that they have to focus on, and you really do have to triage. And I think a lot of times the mental health piece goes unaddressed, not because people are unaware that it is there. I think any pediatrician that you talk to will tell you that they spend a large amount of time, you know, having discussions about behavioral health. But that's not how they were trained. Right? Like physician or medical training, they have a little bit of training in some kind of broad mental health or behavioral or parenting concerns, But that, you know, it's hard for them to kind of get down and dirty in that. And with the rate with which we see mental health and behavioral concerns in individuals with chronic illness, that's even more accentuated. And I think that's those are the numbers that you really see in the literature. It's not for lack of trying. It is mostly a lack of access issue and a lack of training issue. But what I will say is, you know, the name of our program, I think, aptly talks to what we need to be looking at, which is whole child treatment. That is not just system or organ specific, but thinking about, you know, how does everything work together? I think intuitively this makes sense. But if you want a really specific example, what that ends up looking like is, you know, mental health gets in the way of adherence, right? If you're depressed, if you're frustrated, if you're burned out on your illness, you know, you lose motivation. You feel apathy. I mean, we all know these symptoms of depression, right? And that is going to impact illness progression in a pretty major way, because when you stop doing the care that you need to be doing, then your illness can take over, get exacerbated, or, you know, make you come into the hospital for acute treatment. And also we can, those things can be not necessarily avoided, but the impact of that can be treated in a primary care setting with, you know, some mental health integration. It really is so important to think about how things go together, because it's a bi-directional relationship, right? So chronic illness definitely predisposes you for mental health concerns, but we also have to think about individuals who might have a pre-existing mental health condition that then get diagnosed with a chronic illness. Right. And in order to set people up for the best opportunity for success possible, thinking about the interplay of those two things ends up being really important.
Not to minimize the danger of illnesses like asthma or diabetes, for example, but we do also see children who have the scary illnesses that we don't like to talk about, cancer, leukemia. I'm curious how your role changes when the child's illness is potentially fatal or when they have been found to be terminal.
Yeah. So certainly in both the inpatient and outpatient environments where we see whole child clients, we do have, you know, it is a small percentage, but it is definitely a percentage of individuals who have a life-limiting illness. And our role there is really dependent on the client's goals and where they are in their illness progression. You know, we see genetic disorders like muscular dystrophy and cystic fibrosis, which we know are life-limiting. And then we have some definitely kind of oncology or hem-onc patients that we see as well. And our role is certainly still mental health focused and developing kind of goals associated with that. But we also, you know, can kind of step back to think about what is this child or this family's life worth living look like, and help to facilitate conversations around goals of care. Because, you know, these are the questions that children have. We also kind of have a role with medical teams to be able to help them have these conversations, or to be able to have children and families have an open and honest conversation about illness progression. Or even to, you know, ask the questions that they're afraid to ask about, you know, what might be going on with them or what treatment means, or, you know, even the question that a lot of kids have, even when they come into the hospital without a life-limiting illness, it feels like a trauma. It feels very serious, because it is. You know, the question that they sometimes have is, am I going to die? And so we partner with the relevant people on their medical team to be able to answer those questions for them.
What's the parent's role in helping you have that conversation, especially if it's a small child, for example, for whom the concept of death might be somewhat nebulous?
Yeah. I mean, The parent's role is super important, and the family's goals are really important. We often ask families, you know, what are your values as a family? What's important to you? When you think about your child and their life, what do you imagine or want that to look like? And we kind of take their lead. And we're lucky enough to work with, you know, a palliative care team here at Miller Children's that is very, very well-versed to being able to have these conversations. And so we get to kind of maybe luckily take a backseat to some of those really hard goals of care conversations and instead be able to layer in to provide emotional support to both parents and children. But we have a lot of values-oriented conversations.
That makes sense. It should come as no surprise to our listeners that parents are one of the most important factors in the life and well-being of a developing child. That becomes even more true when a child is chronically ill. Parents and caregivers have to bring the child to and from treatment, know when a hospitalization may be indicated, ensure that the child is adhering to treatment and medication expectations. Parents play another very important role in the life of a child who is ill. Their response to the child's illness sets the stage for the child's understanding of what is wrong and how to manage it. Dr. Jamie Howard of Child Mind Institute notes that parents may have a really hard time, and that can set the tone for the recovery. If the child is very young, they may feel confused or anxious because they might not understand why their parent is worried. Or if the parent is feeling like their child is fragile or in danger, the child may start thinking that too, and it can affect their self-identity and ability to be resilient. The contrast may also be true. Doctors Rohan and Verma shared case studies of caregivers who were disengaged in the child's medical treatment, too overwhelmed by the illness and their own pre-existing life stressors. Adherence to medication and treatment regimen suffered, as did the child's well-being. So, talking about sort of the values conversation and the role parents play as a really vital part of the treatment team, how do you support them? I imagine some parents must really struggle with having these sort of life and death or treatment conversations with their children.
Yeah. Parents and caregivers play a vital role in their child's life. They are their protectors, they set boundaries, they are largely responsible for decision-making associated with medical care, they monitor the actual, you know, day-to-day living of their child, and that is a lot. That's a lot. And parents are so important in being able to support that. And so, you know, we partner with parents to be able to accomplish what their goals are as caregivers to their children. Sometimes we look at pain points, right? Of like, how do you set boundaries with a kid that you feel really sad for because they're in pain all the time, right? Or how do you push a kid to get back to living their life and going to school when they say, I'm too tired, I don't want to. Right. And what does that look like? We try and involve caregivers and family members as much as possible in the process because illnesses are not limited to the child who has that diagnosis. They are a family process for sure. And parents and caregivers play an important role in that.
You know, one of the things that we've touched on a bit is how sort of relentless these diseases are, even the ones that we've talked about that are medically managed, like asthma or diabetes or really severe allergies, but they are relentless. They don't go away. You can't say, I'm not taking my insulin today. You can't say, I don't want to check for peanuts at this restaurant. I just want to sit down and eat. And you know, we work so often in children's mental health on the parent-child relationship and that dynamic. And how does this sort of relentlessness of chronic illness impact the parent-child relationship and dynamic, especially as the child's growing up?
So I think you know, the answer that I always give is it depends. But I think really the impacts that we see on the parent-child relationship are not that different than what we might see typically, right? So like your mom or grandma or whoever is nagging you to clean your room, right? That also translates into nagging you to take your insulin or take your medication or check your blood sugar or do your vest treatment or whatever it is. It's those same kind of conversations and pain points. They're not different. It's just the contents of them is different. I think where we see maybe some increased impact is when we think about the accumulative stress, right? So we have normal stresses at developmental stages on parent-child relationships. And then there's like, and we also have to be talking about your chronic illness process and what that looks like.
You know, I imagine it from the perspective of a teen. And, you know, admittedly, I'm biased in that regard. With two 18-year-olds that I got through those more complicated early teen years. But, you know, I think about the push-pull of that parent-child relationship and the anxiety you feel as a parent as you're giving them gradually more autonomy and more independence. And, you know, they need it. It makes you anxious. And it is this sort of push-pull the first time they come home from school alone without someone picking them up or that, you know, as you're negotiating curfew and all of those elements and the stressors that there are in the relationship around that, I can't imagine adding a chronic or serious illness into that dynamic as well. You know, the anxiety I felt lying on the couch waiting until they got home and the frustration they felt with me that I wouldn't go to bed till they got home. And they're healthy. So, you know, I just wonder. It's like throwing additional fuel on that fire of the parent and teen relationship.
Yeah, I think you're right on target that it is kind of adding this additional stressor, right? Because it is very normal to be anxious as your teenager is navigating their own autonomy and identity and who they are, who they want to be as a person in this world, right? What they want to stand for, what's important to them. Those are all very typical developmental tasks that cause a lot of a very understandable, but nonetheless significant anxiety in parents. And I think what we layer in is things like, you know, you're waiting on the couch, waiting for your child to come home, and also wondering whether or not they had a seizure while they were out with their friends. Right. And was somebody there to notice? Did that person know what to do? Did my child, you know, even though we've talked about this over and over and over and over again, know what to do? Are they hurt somewhere? Right. I think those are the kind of extra worries. And I think the other worries that come up related to this are how much autonomy do I give my child in taking care of and managing their illness? Like, at what point do they become responsible? And I think all parents feel differently about this. And in our program, we advocate for, you know, developmentally appropriate responsibility, right? We wouldn't ever put a 10-year-old in charge of their entire diabetic care and regimen. But certainly we would have them, you know, setting alarms, you know, in the home for blood sugar checks or things like that. But that's definitely a navigation that happens as well. Right, with somebody wanting to be in charge of their own care, but maybe not totally being ready for that yet or having the skills for that.
That makes sense. You know, another thing I was thinking about, it's been interesting, just the thought of talking about children who are ill just gets brain spinning, doesn't it, as a parent yourself? But what I tried in preparation for today to consider how it might feel to have a child who is seriously ill, you know, cancer perhaps. And mm-hmm. I, you know, the struggles, like, it's your, go walk the dog. You have to do your homework, pick up. No, you can't have any dessert. You didn't eat enough dinner. All of those things we do as parents. I imagine it'd be really hard to do that to some degree if you have a child who's ill. Of course we can have pizza every night. Of course we can have cake every night. You're sick. Could you talk for a little bit about why this would not be the right approach?
Yeah.
Although it might be a natural one. That is not appropriate, no matter what your child is facing.
So when we think about, you know, doing very understandable things like wanting to protect how our child feels and not put undue burdens on them, what ends up happening, and, you know, it's definitely not on purpose, but that we end up lacking boundaries and structure. And that is frightening to children when they don't know what to expect, especially to young children. You can think about any young child in your life, and, you know, you can kind of ask yourself, where does this child, where are they their best self? And usually we answer with, you know, highly structured, predictable environments where they know what is expected of them and how other people are going to react in a situation. And, you know, this is not always possible, right? It just, in terms of life in general, it's not always possible. But generally young children and even older children thrive when there are boundaries. And so, you know, I feel bad for you, so I'm going to give you pizza every night, sends a couple of different messages. So, right, it's unpredictable and there are no boundaries. But also, it kind of inadvertently sends this message that things are really bad, right? Like, it must be real bad if my formerly very consistent, very strict caregiver is all of a sudden letting me do whatever I want.
That would be scary.
The end must be near,
wow,
right?
It must be really sick.
Right. Yeah.
Well, that leads me to another question that about the conversations of death or illness or what have you between the parent and the child. And I'm sure some parents would want to protect their child from knowing sort of the details of their illness. And from what you're saying here, that would lead me to think that would be scary.
Yeah.
For the child as well.
I think you're absolutely right. You know, each individual family's belief system and values are their own. And I am not in the business of telling other people what is best for them, because the reality is I'm not them and I don't know. I think I work from a place of, our palliative care team says this and I love it. Why is this loving parent making this loving choice? And trying to understand what that means for them. I will say that when you look at the research and you look at parents who have lost children to chronic illness and deciding whether or not to tell them about their illness, to tell them that they were going to die, you know, parents unequivocally come down on the side of, I wish I would have had that conversation. And for those who did, I am happy that I did. But there are always the parents who don't and are comfortable with that decision. And so there is, you know, as much as we might be uncomfortable with it, there is no right answer. There is what is best for your child and your family. When it comes to that, I think everybody's feelings and our own values get in the way when we think about this. It feels a little cringy, right? To have a kid not know what's going on with them. The other thing that I would add there is that children are imaginative. They are creative. Their brains work in amazing, mind-blowing ways. When they have very small bits of information, because they are observant, because they overhear things, but they do not have context and perspective, they connect dots that don't necessarily need to be connected. And so sometimes what can happen is our best intention actually backfires, and what is in their head in terms of what's going on is way bigger and way scarier than what the reality is. And so when we're thinking about information sharing with children, we have to think about, you know, what might they be thinking in their mind? We can always ask them, what do you know? What have you been thinking about? But definitely something to consider when we're thinking about, do we, don't we tell them things?
What's their understanding going to be if we don't?
And what pieces might they put together?
Sense.
Like, they come to the hospital every day, right, for medication or whatever it is. Like, what are they thinking is happening if you haven't told them what's going on?
Right. I can imagine that would be scary. You know, Lauren, you have a very difficult job. I don't know very many people who are comfortable thinking about children who are ill, and in some cases, perhaps terminally. You seek this out. You very clearly love what you do. Every conversation we've ever had about this, it's so clear that you love what you do. What are the sort of unexpected bright sides in your work? What gives you hope as you do this?
Oh, man, that's a good question. I do love what I do. I think, you know, it's very similar. You've told me before that, you know, you love trauma work, right? You love it. And you get the same response that I do, which is like, oh my gosh, I don't know how you could do that work. It's so sad and heavy, right? And yet it is meaningful for you and you love it. And I feel the exact same way about this work. I think unexpected bright sides are, especially in the hospital environment, we have the ability to see change very quickly, which is somewhat unusual in the mental health environment. And I love that. I love that we can, you know, come in and really change quality of life quickly, and make everybody feel more successful. That's the other thing that I really like about, you know, my work, is that we're not necessarily outcomes driven in terms of like, you know, what is the medical outcome for that child, but more about like, how do we make everybody feel as successful as possible and like they are their best selves? And those are the bright sides. And what gives me hope, pretty much everybody that I interact with, and just seeing how people can really come together to, as a community and as a team, to care for a child and their family.
You always inspire me, Lauren. It never fails.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for being with us here today. I appreciate it.
Thanks. I am so grateful to have this opportunity and to get to talk about the things that I love.
Given all that we have learned together about the impact of trauma on a child's well-being, I don't imagine it came as a surprise to our listeners that having a chronic illness can lead to high rates of comorbid psychiatric problems in these already vulnerable children. From my perspective, mental health and family support services should be an integral part of any treatment plan for an ill child or teen. We can do better by our patients, and data strongly supports that health outcomes improve when children are coping better. I hope that we've all gained some insight through today's conversation. It's my position that by shining a light on these issues, admitting that they are in our own backyards, it will be easier for someone struggling to get some help. Through conversation, we can become agents of change.
In My Backyard is brought to you by the Guidance Center, a children's mental health agency in Long Beach, California. In My Backyard is produced by Tricia Costales and Matthew Murray. Thank you to J. Vincent B. for original music. All other music licensed through Soundstripe. Thank you to our listeners and supporters. Please visit tgclb.org or text HOPE to 562-262-5689 to make a one-time donation or join our Hope and Healing Club to become a monthly donor today. Subscribe to In My Backyard on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.